other one, being in, you know, as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a state, a stakeholder, also having projects with India, being a state, because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets once lying discarded on the roadside have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held, bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries, those have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different West Western universities, they supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think it requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices, and it is then forgotten. Well, Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire. The massacres continue. The genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was observed at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa compound in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. A ceremony was held on Tuesday, bringing together representatives from the UN, the African Union, and ambassadors from various countries. The event highlighted decades of suffering faced by the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Palestinian people's suffering has intensified under decades of a belligerent Israeli occupation, which has relentlessly targeted our land, the people, and every aspect of life in Palestine, culminating in an atrocious genocide in the Gaza Strip, confirmed by numerous UN and international human rights reports.
Injustice also continues in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, with Israel military operations, settlers, violence, settlement expansions, evictions, demolitions, and threats of annexations. At the same time, hundreds of humanitarian workers have been killed. The majority were Palestinians, UN staff, marking the largest loss of personnel in the organization's history. More journalists have perished than in any other conflict since the Second World War.
Participants expressed support for the Palestinians' legitimate rights, including the right to have independent states.
The Middle East region will not be able to emerge from the successive crises unless the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people to establish his own independent state are recognized.
Despite the UN's annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people and global calls to address the ongoing crisis, Palestinians continue to face a grave ordeal in the history of humanity. And this event in Addis Ababa urges the international community to move beyond rhetoric and support the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian people in their quest for self-determination.
As we reflect on the hardship endured by millions of Palestinians, we are reminded that solidarity is not merely symbolic. It is a moral imperative. It is a wake-up call to the international community to redouble its commitment.
The event concluded with the 40 exhibition featuring the tragedies occurring in Gaza, honoring ambassadors whose countries have recognized the state of Palestine, and the flag-raising ceremony. Amanil Gabramatin, Addis Ababa.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Voice of War. My guest today is Professor Ilan Pape, one of the most prominent and provocative historians of the modern Middle East. He is the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and is best known for his groundbreaking work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his books The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Lobbying for Zionism. His latest book, Israel on the Brink, offers a sobering diagnosis of what he sees as seven internal cracks threatening the future of the Israeli state, while also tracing the deeper historical, ideological, and geopolitical forces that have shaped its path. Ilan, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
It's a great pleasure to be on The Voice of War in the program. Thank you very much for having me. Great.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very grateful that we finally be able to lock it in. Maybe we can start straight away with your most recent book, Israel on the Brink. In it, you open up by saying Israel's demise is inevitable, not because you're a determinist, but because the process is already in motion. So what signs of this internal unraveling do you see most clearly?
Yeah. I think each process that I identify in the book by itself is not powerful enough either to bring a regime change or disintegration or a fall. I mean, I'm not a prophet, so I don't know exactly what will happen. But I do feel that the structure that is a state and ideological project is collapsing. One very important one is the internal implosion, the implosion from within the Israeli Jewish society. And this goes to one of the two basic challenges Zionism had. One, and we'll talk about it a bit later, is the challenge of imposing a European state on the Arab world at the expense of a local indigenous Palestinian people. But the other challenge, and that's what is really part of the internal implosion is all about in Israel, is the challenge of defining a religion as nationalism, defining Judaism as nationalism and not as religion. And it took time, and now it's very clear that this is not an intellectual debate. What does it mean to be a Jewish state? What does it mean to be a Jew in Israel? It became a struggle for life and death between those who thought that Judaism can be equated with pluralism, liberal practices, democracy, and so on, be that as it may, only for the Jews, not for the Palestinians, or those who say, no, if it's a Jewish state, then it's a theocracy, then it is a messianic state, then it is loyal to everything that they read in the Bible, everything that they read in the sacred writings or books that were published after the Bible, kind of what we call the halacha in Jewish, the halacha is like the Sharia, it's the kind of the law, the Jewish law state. As I said, this is not academic. That means that it defines the public space, it defines the laws of the land. It also defines the attitude towards the Palestinians, and not only the Palestinians, but also to the neighboring Arab state, because this particular version that has been developed and now is tearing the Jewish society apart from within is also messianic. So they believe that they have an historical opportunity to rebuild probably a kingdom that never existed, because it's all a fable, the kingdom of Solomon and David. But they want to recreate it, and it extends even beyond Palestine. So that's one very powerful process. As I say, not by itself leading to collapse, but with the other, it's very powerful. Mm. And there is a dynamic here, because this is the trajectory, because this is the orientation of the Israeli Jewish society, it increases the isolation of Israel in the world. Israel is losing its traditional allies. And now it's very clear that the civil society regards Israel as a pariah state, but it will, I believe, eventually affect governments and political elites, and even economic elites, not for moral reasons, but because it would not be a very good place to invest money. So you have the isolation from the outside. You also have a Palestinian society that, yes, right now is led by a very fragmented, disunited, and not very capable political elite, but it's a very young society. As I show in the book, the younger generation is far more united, assertive, knowledgeable, and I do believe it will have its say in the future, and it would not use the same kind of diplomacy and tactic as the present political elite. It would be much more devoted, I think, to liberation and decolonization, and would ask the world to support that kind of a Palestinian position. So with the other two processes I described, this may be more possible. It's not possible now to enlist the world, let's say, the world's support for the idea of a one state or the decolonized Palestine. But if the two other processes that I'm describing would indeed develop, then it is possible. This also goes along with a very deep economic crisis. Israel is now preparing itself for decades of war economy. War economies can survive 3, 4, 5 years. They cannot survive a decade. So I foresee a very deep economic crisis as well that would depend very much on the American taxpayer. And I don't think either Republicans or Democrats in the distant future would continue to be so generous with the money of the American taxpayer. And to that I would add, and with this I would finish, and just to give a bit of a display here, the disassociation of Jews, especially young Jews, from the idea of Zionism in Israel. Israel is losing the younger Jewish generation, especially in the United States. And without that kind of support, you remain depending on material interests and not, moral interests. And I don't know how long can a regime rely only on material, economic, and military interests to sustain a state for a very long time. It's not a matter that the state disappears, states don't disappear, but to keep the people that you need to maintain a state in a war economy, isolation, a pariah state, where the Jews in the world do not support you, would be very, very difficult in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to pivot back to that first point, and that's the internal fractures that you've described inside Israel itself. I mean, what we see in the West, and you know this far better than I do, is that we get the impression that the society is cohesive as a whole, and its popular support for the Gaza war in particular, and also for what's happening in the West Bank. And you also draw the distinction in the book between the state of Judea and the state of Israel. So can you just give us a little bit more insight into what you mean by this internal fracture, and how much that actually has, how much of a chance that actually had, to bring about some change in the Israeli government?
Yeah, we have to look at it the other way around, in a way. The idea in Israel was that whatever are the terms of dissent or the disagreements, there is a common enemy. And at the time that you face the common enemy, all the disagreements are forgotten and we're all united. Now, this may be true for the short wars that Israel had, 6 days war, 3 weeks war in 1973. No, this cannot, when we see it's happening, folding in front of our eyes, this kind of unity cannot be held for 2 years. So, to begin with, yes, there was a total support for everyone in the Jewish society for the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip as a reaction to the 7th of October 2023 Hamas attack. But then all the dissent and conflict, the internal conflict that preceded the 7th of October, by which you had two entities, and I will describe them in a minute, fighting for the whole, everything that the state can offer in terms of institutions and powers, that internal conflict reappeared about 6 or 7 months into the war. So for half a year you had a sense of a cohesion, and it affected the dissent affected every aspect. Maybe this is not reported enough in the world, but even on the issue of the hostages, a certain camp, which I call the State of Judea, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that, the State of Judea was not that concerned about the fate of the hostages because they belonged to the other camp, to the liberal, secular camp. So they showed no much compassion for them.
These are people from the kibbutzim, etc., right?
Yeah, exactly. People were regarded to be the left of Israel. They're the ones who mostly were either killed or abducted. And they were attacked. The families were attacked as traitors and as undermining the military effort. So the cohesion isn't there anymore. It wasn't there. The war or the genocide or the operation, call it what you want, cannot gloss over the kind of division that occurred, I would say, at the beginning of this century, between what I call the State of Judea, that is a group, an ideological movement that grew in the Jewish settlements in the West Bank and gained more and more support among the less well-off sections of the Israeli society, mainly people from originally from North African Jewish origin, and from Orthodox and traditional Jewish people, creating this vision of a state that is run by religious law, that does not need democracy, nor does it have any inhibitions in dealing with the Palestinians and even with the Arab neighbors, recreating this ancient kingdom that everybody would respect and fear, not only in Palestine, but all over the Arab world. And luckily, there are these populist allies like Trump, populist fascist leaders in Europe, Modi in India, and so on. So they didn't even feel that they were isolated internationally, not to mention that some of the Arab rulers were very willing to go along with this kind of a vision of a future. The State of Israel is the old state, the one that tried unsuccessfully, which is one today, but has tried to reconcile universal values as democracy, socialism, and liberalism with the idea of a racist ethnic state. They didn't succeed, but at least they attempted. And they created at least a democracy for the Jews in Israel, if not for the Palestinians in it. And they were already losing the battle before the 7th of October 2023. And the events of the 7th of October and after that do not help the chances of success. In fact, it led to a huge immigration. We don't know the numbers, but hundreds of thousands of what I call the State of Israel residents, if you want, with their money, because they have dual nationality, because they have jobs that they can ignite elsewhere. So all of it creates not only a kind of a cold civil war, it creates a vacuum in the elite. And in fact, the only bastion remaining that the State of Judea hasn't taken over is the judicial system. But they are doing their best now to complete the mission there as well.
Which is why we saw protests over the past several, certainly even before October 7th, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of secular State of Israel, so to speak, realized that this is the last battle. I mean, if they take over the judicial system, not much is left for the others.
How did Israel get to this point? I mean, we often hear it described as the most far-right government. Of course, Netanyahu's been around for, you know, three decades in one form or another. How did Israel get to this point?
Well, I think the problem was that what the old Israel offered was impossible. You cannot square the circle. You cannot really create a state that is both Jewish and democratic. Because the only definition that they had of Judaism was an ethnic definition, which meant that the ethnicity of the state did not respect or did not represent, first of all, 20% of the people who were not Jewish, secondly, did not represent the millions of people that Israel kicked out of Palestine in 1948, and did not resolve the issue that was at the very heart of Zionism, namely the imposition of a European Jewish state on the heart of the Arab world at the expense of the Palestinians. So all these attempts, eventually by the Israeli Jewish electorate, were seen as not leading to any kind of resolution. Israel needed to continue and police by force millions of Palestinians, a situation that not so dramatically as it happened in the last 2 years, but incrementally eroded the legitimacy of the state, eroded the support among Jews and others to the idea of Israel. The international community began to, you know, to pay attention in the 1990s and ever since then to the constant violation of human rights and civil rights by Israel. So there was no dividends from this game, and I think there was an exhaustion in the Jewish society. You cheat yourself, you cheat the world, and eventually it doesn't really work. So I think that's one major reason for that. The second reason is, of course, the cycle of violence, because once you violently invade the country and there is a reaction, the reaction is not always non-violent. It's violent as well. And this cycle that once the resistance to your wish to dispossess the people is an armed struggle or a guerrilla warfare, the reaction of the state is even more severe and violent. And in turn, that creates another more vicious, if you want, of bloodshed and violence. So it's easy to convince the population that this is life. There's no other option. The only option is to kill, to wound, to fight, to genocide, and so on. Unfortunately, we didn't have the right people who would show the courage and lead a different kind of a movement and say, well, the conclusion from that reality is that the idea of a Jewish state is the problem here. And there are alternatives which are more humane, that most people in the world cherish in their own country, which is a purely democratic country, and not an ethnic racist country. But that, when that choice had to be made between, are you willing to be a real democracy, or you want to be actually an apartheid racist state? Unfortunately, most of the Jews voted in one way or another for the latter option. Because the first option means giving up all the privileges, the land, the resources, everything you rob from the indigenous people, and you don't want to give it back unless you are forced to do so.
Yeah, and forcing it has been a big challenge, which I think brings me to the next point. And you rightly identified that, of course, the global opinion of Israel is rapidly shifting. And you dedicate in the Israel lobby several chapters to explaining how the pro-Israel advocacy networks, or AIPAC in short, especially in the US and UK, have shaped public discourse and foreign policy. So can you tell us about those networks and what impact they've actually had on US in particular, but of course UK as well as foreign policy?
Yes. First of all, we have to appreciate the longevity of this effort. It starts very early on, in around 1900, becomes already quite an impressive.
That's how thick the book is to dive into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's a more than a century of advocacy, and one should not underestimate the importance of experience. You know, if you exist for such a long time, of course, as the year passed by, you are much more experienced, and you already have an aura of a very powerful organization that you better not deal with. Like you do what they want. Even if they don't approach you directly or threaten you directly. So I think it's important to understand that from the very beginning, I think, Zionist ideologues and leaders understood that there was a moral issue. There was a moral problem with the idea that the only solution for the European racism towards Jews was to impose a Jewish state on the Arab world at the expense of the Palestinians. They understood that this was something that in a world that began to talk about decolonization, a world especially after the Second World War, talked about human rights, had the Human Rights Declaration of 1948, created the United Nations and wanted to protect people from further oppression, a world that wanted to prevent a third world war given the horrific consequences of the two first, well, the first and second world war. In that world, however you presented the Zionist project, it was a project of dispossession and elimination of the native people. Even when good intentions were part of it, as long as you were loyal to the idea that this has to be a Jewish state, there was no way of respecting the new universal code, moral code that the world, especially the West, pretended to adopt. It adopted it in a very exceptional, hypocritical way, but that's another story. In any case, so the advocacy had to take into account, I think very, very early on, and I show it in the book, that they have very little chance of winning the moral debate. That if you want, the facts were on the side of the Palestinians. The truth was on the side of the Palestinians. So what do you do? You need an advocacy that is much more a structure of coercion, maybe temptation, sometimes pressure, in order to make sure that the people with power would see it in their interest to support you. Maybe some of them would be convinced morally, you know, ideologically, that what you do is fine. And I think at the beginning it was a bit easier for the lobby, because you could convince American white settlers that white Jewish settlers have the right to settle someone else's, colonize someone else's homeland, also Australian. I could be easily convinced by that. All three settler colonial projects definitely supported each other morally, despite the injustice that was an integral part of their project. You could convince Christian Zionists that this is a project that would lead to the resurrection of the dead, the return of Jesus, and so on. And then also convince the West that this is a Western democracy in a sea of Arab and Islamic barbarism. The problem was for the lobby that as we move from 48 and we reach 1967, and the occupation is far more transparent and exposed to everyone to see and understand, it's much more difficult to build a moral justification for the daily oppression of the Palestinians. And that's when the lobby begins to use the tactics of, as I said, inducement and coercion. And it's very effective. It knows how to do it. It accompanies politicians in Britain and in the United States from very early stages in their careers, so that they would be committed to the cause when they begin their political career, and then you can ask for the dividends or for the payback later on if they reach a more powerful position. You destroy politicians if they dare to challenge the lobby, you use money, power, clout, political clout, and of course, as I said before, the cycle of violence, the way the Palestinian resistance developed objectively here and there, helped the lobby to say, you see, huh? see who we're dealing with.
We're dealing with terrorists.
The terrorists, exactly. 9/11 was the point that everybody thought this would be the most successful moment of the lobby, that they would associate 9/11 with Palestine. They didn't take into account that already in 2001 and 9/11, the civil society, even in the United States, were far more knowledgeable, far more sophisticated, and understood very well that you cannot compare the Palestinian resistance and anti-colonialist struggle for freedom and liberation with the acts of terrorism committed by Al-Qaeda on the American soil. And that is something the lobby doesn't know how to deal with ever since. Yeah.
As in the civil society piece?
Yeah, the civil society, the fact that the internet allows far more information and knowledge. The Z generation, Generation Z, and even the one before it, are curious people, are alert to fake news to fabrication. We call them naive, but they do understand who is a victim and who is a victimizer. We saw it in the demonstration in the U.S. and elsewhere, in Italy in particular, for instance. They are not mesmerized by the main shield of immunity Israel provides, which is to say it's very complicated, and only we, a complicated issue, and we are the only ones who really understand it, and you have to listen to our, yeah. And they don't buy it anymore, and the lobby doesn't know what to do with it, you know? Yeah.
Thank you. good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali baytihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Brothers, sisters, listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. We were discussing in the previous episodes, and we're still discussing the relationship between people and the government and the Islamic government. One of the things that people are required to do when it comes to an Islamic system is to participate in its political activities, specifically like voting. Now, I'm one of the people who don't take voting very lightly. I don't vote very quickly, nor do I refrain from voting. Now, if we live in a system that is independent from the influence of Western and foreign powers, and you know what I mean, and our country is independent in the sense that we do not have foreign troops on our lands, and we're completely independent, and we don't have their embassies on our lands, we have nothing to do with them, they have nothing to do with us. In fact, we are arch enemies. If that's the system I'm living in, 100% I'm going to vote. If it's not, if I have one soldier in my land, that's a foreign soldier, by the government that I'm living under, I'm not going to vote. Does that make sense? Okay, now, when it comes to dealing with an Islamic system, with the condition that it is an Islamic system that is completely independent, we need to vote in that system. We need to be active members of that system. Because if we don't go to the votes, and we don't vote for the right people, for the people who have qualification, people who have the skills, people who are God-fearing, what we're doing is we're creating a vacuum for the corruptors to come along. And we see that happens over and over and over again. Where people say, oh, you know what, we had the previous government, they didn't do anything, so why should we vote? I'm not going to vote. And they don't vote, and that's exactly what the other party wants. And one of their propaganda actually is this. They start to release so much media of how corrupted the previous governments were, and therefore, why should we vote? Why should we give our votes to them, to anyone in this case? When that vacuum is created, the bad ones would come and change everything around, and they take power. As I said, we can see that happens time and time over. So we have to be very careful not to let bad people, evil people, to come into power. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says, وَإِذَا كَانَ أُمَرَاءُكُمْ شِرَارُكُمْ. When your kings and your rulers are the worst, وَأَغْنِيَاءُكُمْ بُخَلَاء, and your traders, those who deal, make businesses, are stingy, وَلَمْ يَكُنْ أَمْرُكُمْ شُورَى بَيْنُكُمْ, and your affair is not a consultation between yous, voting, فَبَطْنُ الْأَرْضِ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ مِنْ ظَاهِرِهَا. The beneath of the earth is much better for you than being on the earth. Basically, the Prophet says, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, is saying, being dead is much better than being alive, if that's the system that you have, where the bad people are in power, the businessmen are corrupted, and you guys don't have a say in anything. Then how good is that world or that system that you live in? Now, let us take a short break, and then we will continue this discussion, inshallah.
Ayatollah Javadi Amiri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life. Now, we said that people need to be involved in the political system because it concerns them. Now, you're not just electing a person for the sake of him being in power position. You're electing a person that's supposed to help you, that's supposed to serve you. So you're doing it for yourself. That's the idea. Not doing it for that person himself to be in power. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, when he talks about the concept of, you know, becoming involved and getting involved, which is a statement, a very powerful statement, in the Khitbah al-Sheikh Shaqiyya of Najul Balagh, where he talks about Khilafah being taken from him. He said, if I had people supporting me, and this is a question a lot of people raise against Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, oh, why didn't he fight if he believes he was right? Well, he's saying, if people would have came to me, if people would have supported me, if people would have, you know, stood by me, I would have flipped it, you know, the right to the left, went all out. But people decided to let a couple of men use their power and force people to accept them as kings and accept their narrative. And people submitted under the will of the sword. And that's a problem. And we see that in Saqifa. Saqifa wasn't a democratic election at all. A few people from Muhajirin and Ansar, they sat down between themselves. They were fighting for almost 3 days who should be the ruler. And people had no idea what was going on because people were upset and they were sad and grieving over the loss of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And then all of a sudden these men march on the pulpit of the Prophet and acclaim kingship. And the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is lying right in front of them. But Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi himself, he said, well, no one came along, no one showed support. So again, the Muslims have that requirement that they need to say to people, hold on a second. This is not a dictatorship. We have a say in who we choose to become our leader. We have that choice. We have that right, actually. It's one of our rights, is for us to choose. So when they don't choose, when people decide to forfeit that right of theirs, we're going to have problems. So you had the first king, the second king, the third king. By the time of the third king, things went really wrong for the Muslims. And still is until today we are suffering because of what happened back in that time. So now when we're living in an Islamic country, an Islamic system, and there's a voting system, we need to go to the voting system. We need to elect and select the correct people. If we don't, then be sure bad and corrupted people will come into power, and we should not allow that to happen. And obviously, like I said, keeping in mind that the system that we're going to elect and support is a system that is independent in its thought, independent in its actions, is not afraid, not scared, does not give charity, taxes, commissions, money whatsoever to any other foreign power for the sake of security and safety. We don't live in a kingship countries where we have a king and a queen. That does not work in an Islamic kind of system. People have to choose and elect for themselves, by themselves. I leave it here, and inshallah, we will continue this discussion in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're tuned into your trusted companion on the airwaves, Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran. We're grateful you've chosen to spend part of your day with us. First up, it's time for news. Following the news, join us for Foresight. This program explores the practical dimensions of worship and servitude to Allah in confronting the challenges of modern life. Featuring lectures and speeches by renowned English-speaking scholars from the Islamic world, Foresight focuses on deepening understanding of devotion to God as a guiding principle for contemporary issues. Afterwards, we return with another segment of radio production. Coming up next, news. Please stay tuned.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history.
go ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A reminder of our top stories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's legalization of 19 settlements marks a dangerous shift that reduces Palestinian land to colonial spoils. Deadly clashes continue in Thailand and Cambodia border despite claims by the US president that both sides have agreed to halt hostilities. And the US admiral, critical of Washington's boat strikes in Latin America, retires following differences with the administration over the military operations there. Live from Tehran, I am Bahman Nouri, and this is News. The Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager in Gaza as the regime continues its artillery and airstrikes in the Palestinian territory in violation of the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. 19-year-old Mohammed Sabri was shot dead by Israeli troops in Jabalia, north of the Strip. Meanwhile, the Israeli fighter jets targeted eastern areas of Gaza City. Extensive demolitions of Palestinian houses were also reported east of Khan Yunus. Meanwhile, Rafah City in the south was also targeted multiple times by airstrikes. This is while Storm Byron has claimed the lives of 14 Palestinians with fierce winds and flooding, leaving 1.5 million displaced Gazans in danger. The United Nations has slammed Israel for blocking the much-needed supplies for the Palestinians living in makeshift tents as a political choice. Let us now cross